The Gates of Horn and Ivory, by Francis Rosenfeld. Chapter 1. The Haunted Caves. They saw it from afar, as they were travelling among the clouds in Alioz's chariot, the strange city of caves, carved in the soapstone of a cluster of spiky cliffs, sometimes by nature, sometimes by man, displayed amid the arid landscape like a giant sculpture, maybe an artifact the Titans left behind, before his love of humankind landed Prometheus his penance. A huge human beehive it seemed to be, where the diligent workers moved about through hundreds of holes in the stone cliffs towards the innards of the place, dug deep into the earth, the huge underground metropolis that marked the beating heart of Anatolia. A large delegation welcomed the goddesses, with the traditional sheaves of grain and prolonged orations, and when it was done prostrating, the group surrounded them like living water and carried them down stairs and ramps through large subterranean chambers and hallways, past people carrying on their mundane activities, past carved galleries and alleys and arcades, public spaces and ventilation shafts, temples, tombs, and sanitation systems, stables and wells and water reservoirs. All the parts of a flawlessly functioning city, miles beneath the Earth's surface, illuminated only by Prometheus's gift. There seemed to be no bottom to this upside-down underground metropolis, and Persephone, who was more versed in the intricacies of subterranean living than her mother, expected to see the glow of red flowing lava at any moment as they continued their seemingly endless descent. The journey ended in the lowermost chamber, a huge arched cave, 50 feet tall, with painted walls depicting epic battles, and scenes of daily activities, prayers for the dead, devotions of the living. The echoes of hundreds of voices were reverberated and amplified by the tall stone vaults, walls, and floor, reaching a deafening, disorienting loudness. The high priests bowed and prostrated themselves at the goddess's feet, and when bid to rise, they guided them down the central aisle towards their stone thrones, carved with agricultural scenes and symbols of the dead, and surrounded by garlands of yellow buttercups and bowls of pomegranates. A young maiden, obviously overcome with emotion, approached them humbly and placed crowns of buttercups on their heads, and then retreated, stricken with awe, to touch the cheek Demeter had caressed in passing. For a moment, Persephone felt like she was back home and was grateful to her mother for this unexpected gift. The voices ceased suddenly when a group of priests brought grains and fruit and livestock for the blessing, as the sacrificial fires were stoked and made fragrant with large bundles of dried sage, chamomile, and mint. "They're not going to sacrifice those here, are they?" Persephone whispered to her mother, who rolled her eyes at her with disdain. "Now you have a problem with death. Of course they're going to sacrifice them. That's the whole point of the trip." She looked at the horrified expression on her daughter's face and got instantly aggravated. "Oh, grow up, will you? People have been looking forward to this feast the entire year. The anticipation of the smells, the horrid sounds of agony, the blood, and the choking smoke of burning meat brought Persephone to the verge of vomiting, as her mother watched her with expectant curiosity and just a hint of happiness. "Can I dare hope that husband of yours finally made himself useful in some capacity? Are you, no? Mother, how can you be so calm? This is horrifying. I'm sure Tartarus is a pleasant vacation spot, dear. Keep your wits about you. You're embarrassing Olympus." Persephone sat on her throne, stone-faced, trying to find a happy place inside her mind as the ritual unfolded and the offerings were sacrificed and burned, grateful for the efficient ventilation system and the platform which put a height barrier between her and the blood on the floor. The ritual finally ended, and the goddesses got up to leave, and as they stepped down from their podium onto the central aisle, the high priest advanced towards them with a bowl of fresh, still warm blood, and marked their foreheads with its sacrificial offering. For a fleeting moment, Persephone's spirit left her body to see herself walk down that aisle, deep inside the bowels of the earth, with a garland of yellow wedding flowers on her head, pale as a ghost, and dressed in immaculate white gauze, which was in stark contrast with the bright red markings on her forehead, the archetypal image of old goddesses of death. She looked at her mother, who was as poised as ever, assuming her role as patroness of the crops and tonic bringer of the harvest with graceful ease, at peace with life, death, and all the stages in between. "The gods don't grow old, they grow callous. You acquitted yourself well of your task, daughter," Demeter commented on the chariot ride back. I was worried you were going to faint or something. A fainting goddess. That would have been the laughingstock of all of Cappadocia, like we don't have enough problems to deal with already. She looked at her daughter, who was still too shaken by the experience to engage in conversation. It's about time you got baptized into the next stage of your existence, Persephone. You're not an innocent maiden anymore, you're a mother now, in spirit, anyway, she commented, displeased. Us mothers live to serve the needs of others, she continued bitterly. The gods know I do. Persephone wondered what would her beloved think if he saw her this day, his innocent young bride all gone to leave room for the stone idol of blood sacrifice, and the disturbing imagery reminded her she still owed Dionysus a conversation regarding the details of his upcoming feast, a bacchanalia, no doubt. She suddenly got angry, thinking this was exactly why she'd rather not leave Hades and its quiet peace. For all the times she saw lamenting souls wandering aimlessly the banks of the Acheron, and sought to comfort them, they were all hailing from here, from this place of life and light, where everybody was constantly striving for power, where the primary emotions, urges, and unseemly desires drove everything. A puddle of grandiose and callous ambitions as red and impossible to wipe clean as the stain of the sacrificial blood on the floor. This is life, daughter, Demeter replied in a more comforting tone. Life is brutal. Not everyone enjoys the privilege of skip-stepping over its challenges directly into the islands of the blessed. Don't you dare judge. You're here to serve. Serve. What's next on the calendar? Persephone effectively ended the subject. We're going to Epidaurus. You're going to tend to the sick. As long as I'm not there to kill them, Persephone thought, relieved, and contemplated the irony of her, of all people, bringing comfort to the afflicted. One would think the mere sight of her was the last thing those people wanted to experience. Well, since your fated decided to cut Asclepius at the knees for messing with his incoming headcount, and kept him hostage in Hades for his reward, you're here to assume his duties. Demeter couldn't help herself. Such a harmonious place of love and light your home is. Actually, it was Zeus who stroke Asclepius down. He's in Hades because he's dead. And I'm sure your husband had nothing to do with it. So, what exactly am I supposed to do in Epidaurus? You will provide dream visitations with advice, comfort, and cures for the sick. Why can't it all be like this? Persephone thought. She loved her work, most of it, anyway. The plants, the oracles, the comforting of souls. It was the brazen, thoughtless infliction of intentional harm she couldn't come to terms with, and that, as she just learned, was the red blood of life itself. No wonder she'd rather be dwelling elsewhere. You should wipe that off, Demeter pointed to her forehead, it might upset the patients. I can't imagine why, Persephone replied bitterly, promptly handed a napkin to clean her forehead by one of the attending Ori, and a bowl of fresh water to wash up her face by another. She saw her face in the water's surface, unchanged, if only a little pale, remembered the saying after a certain age people have to wear the countenance they earned for themselves and was now sure that wasn't true. All of world's cruelty stays neatly hidden behind a facade of blameless faces, of faces just like hers. She rested her eyes on the slow-moving landscape below. She was sure they were traveling faster than time itself in Aelios's chariot, it's just one could barely tell, so high up in the sky. From far above, the cradle of life looked so beautiful, so peaceful, a true blessed Eden. No wonder the Olympians did not understand its struggles. Dusk was approaching, and as Persephone's friend Nyx covered the earth with her mantle, the landscape turned into a black velvet map dotted by points of light, almost like a mirror image of the starry realm. The thick or rarefied clusters of those lights marked the edges of the seas and the crossroads of traveling routes, a very different way of experiencing life's activating principles than one got to see during the day. The night map was so much more telling in terms of people's priorities and focus, stripped bare of the artifice meant for life's embellishment. You're biased, of course, Demeter commented, then turned to the Phaeton driver. We made good time. We'll be there just after the afflicted fall asleep. I'd like to skip the pageantry and get directly down to work for a change, and hopefully get in and out without unnecessary delays. It's been a long day. We're all tired. She brought her attention back to her daughter. Persephone, have some ambrosia, dear. You have eaten nothing all day and you'll be useless if you're light-headed. Persephone received the bowl promptly offered by a third aura and obediently ate the food of the gods.